I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Whether you read the words or hear the voices of the Good Beer Hunting editorial staff, there's one guy working behind the scenes who doesn't get the byline, but offers plenty of insight and guidance to get those things from draft to publish ready. In today's episode of the GBH Collective, we're chatting with the man behind the curtain, Austin L. Ray, editorial director for Good Beer Hunting. We're welcoming him to this special series of interviews where we can dive deeper with GBH contributors and friends on topics of writing, beer, and the stories that we share. If you follow Austin on Twitter, you may know about his eclectic sense of humor and insight into all things agricultural. So while we talk a little bit about how chard can save the world, you'll also hear his unique insight on a couple recent stories he pulled together for GBH that benefit greatly from explaining his behind-the-scenes reporting. Curious about what it's like to chat with a brutally honest owner from Wicked Weed, or why one Atlanta brewery has created trouble and difficult decisions for local bar owners? Austin's your guy. If you've enjoyed listening to these collective episodes to better learn what goes into telling a story, these two from Austin were among the more odd ones we've been able to share on Good Beer Hunting, and you'll likely get a kick out of how they came to be. This is Austin L. Ray, editor, writer, and leafy green enthusiast. Listen in. Hey, Austin.
Hey, Brian.
Welcome to your annual review.
Oh, no.
I guess. I guess thank you for joining.
Sure.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
We talk like every day, but it's a special occasion today.
Yeah, well, normally it's typing, so this is even more special.
Yes, voice to voice. Let's talk about chard.
Okay.
How is your chard coming along right now?
It's terrible. I wrote an essay about chard and about how easy it is to grow it and how, you don't even have to try. You just put it in the ground. Everything's fine. And ever since I did that a couple of years ago, chard no longer grows on my property. So I think that was the universe just teaching me a lesson. Like, try to be a little more humble, Austin.
Well, you can maybe be a little less humble because I'm actually looking at that essay right now. Because I liked the idea behind it. Leading up to it, the premise essentially was you were tweeting about chard a lot.
I don't know
and
where these come from.
It brought happiness, I guess is the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that prompted you to write? This is an essay in Gravy, I think mm-hmm. it was, which is a publication from the Southern Foodways Alliance.
Yeah.
What prompted you to write this? And looking at it from the perspective of chard will save us.
Right. Like you said, I was tweeting about chard a lot and mostly just amusing myself with it and then eventually amusing other people as well. And I just kind of got into I got taken away by it and just kept doing it and trying to find more stupid ways to work chard into tweets. And then this was around the time, my son is 2 now, but right when he was first born, my wife and I were just, you don't sleep very much in those first 6 months. So you're up at night kind of waiting for him to sleep. And I was just, going in and out of sleep and just kind of having that like feverish, you feel a little bit crazy. And in one of those moments, I think it was 3 or 4 in the morning, I was like thinking about what my next chard tweet would be. And instead I was like, I have like a paragraph in my head. Let's just write that paragraph. And then slowly over the weeks of sleeplessness, I just kept adding paragraphs until there were like a couple thousand words. And then I started chopping that around because I was like, this isn't a tweet anymore. This is something I should get paid for.
Do your best tweets come to you in the middle of the night like that?
No, not usually, I don't think. I think best tweets come in the moment, typically.
So legit question, because I mean, you've got over 5,000 followers on Twitter. You are verified. Kind of a big deal.
Pretty internet famous, if we're being real.
What would you say as someone who has had success tweeting about chard? But it goes beyond that. What would you say makes for successful tweeting?
Well, I guess, I think it's one of those like your mileage may vary situations. Like if you're doing it in like some kind of official capacity, it's going to be very different. But for me, it's like, I like things that are dumb, that don't take it too seriously. I always try to remind myself, because like, it's easy to be like, oh man, I want my tweets to get a bunch of likes. Anytime you get to that point, you should just shut it off. Like, go away, stop tweeting, step away from Twitter.com. I try not to take it too seriously. I try to have fun with it.
I mean, your last tweet as we sit down to record this is shout out to Egg Boy. I believe the children are our future.
See, there you go. That's perfect. Like, that took 10 seconds. It got my point across. It doesn't mean anything to 90% of people in the world. did you see Egg Boy, by the way? I'm so happy about Egg Boy. I mean,
I did. I think what impressed me about Egg Boy, and this is was like a 15-year-old kid who threw an egg at the head of a Australian politician who was making very blatant kind of white supremacist statements, I suppose.
I want to clarify real quick. He didn't throw it. He smashed it on his head, like, just in such a like satisfying way. But other than that, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, because he was in one hand, I think it was his left hand, he was holding his cell phone to record it, smashing with the right. And then there was another person behind him recording it as well. And so when I saw that on Twitter for the first time, there were actually like four or five different angles of this happening, all created into one long supercut.
Yeah. It was so fun to see, like, and the story really unfolded. I mean, unfortunately, you saw probably how he gets pinned down and the cops come and everything, but there's like, you can watch it. Like you said, you can watch it from just behind him. You can watch it from the politician's angle. You can kind of see there's like a third, like in the middle angle. It was beautiful. It's just perfect internet.
We'll always remember where we were when we saw Egg Boy for the first time.
Inspired by Egg Boy and his ways.
So talking about weird stuff on the internet, can we talk about this Wicked Weed story that you wrote in February?
For sure. Yeah, a whole different type of weird.
So for those who might not have read, you got the chance to chat with Walt Dickinson from Wicked Weed. He's one of the co-founders there. Because he was doing something maybe kind of sort of in Atlanta that you happened to catch wind of. And what came of that turned into this really kind of bizarre story and conversation that doesn't maybe have complete direction. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe give a little extra background on that, like how this came to be to lead up to you talking to Walt?
Sure. Yeah. So I work in a building called Pond City Market, which is on the Beltline, which is this adaptive reuse project in Atlanta that's kind of changed the way that we move around the city in a lot of ways. The New York Times called it a glorified sidewalk once, which is true, but it's also like this really interesting path that like connects neighborhoods all over the city, like cuts through like all the normal ways that you would drive, and you just walk through what used to be like railways, used to be like forest and different things like that. And so that's there now, and now there's all these businesses popping up along it. And it's just this really interesting thing. So to put that in context, there's some businesses there next to Ponce. And one day a friend of mine from work was walking along the Beltline, and he saw like what appeared to be barrels and some like Wicked Weed branding there on the Beltline. And he took pictures of it and texted them to me on his way to lunch and was just like, what the hell is this? Like, he's a beer guy, and none of us had heard anything about Wicked Weed coming to town. So it was kind of a surprise. And then from there, I think I texted a few people and was trying to get a feel for what was going on. No one knew. And eventually a local sales rep was just like, here's Walt's number. You have time with him on Friday. And I was like, oh, that was really easy. And then we ended up sitting down and talking about it. And I think, as you can see in the interview, he didn't really have answers for what it is. He's going to be pouring his beer in this building, if he can get his permit sorted. But other than that, everything else is kind of up in the air.
And what transpired from that conversation, the responses that you seemed to got were very scattered, both in kind of, it never read or sounded like he was being evasive so much as it just really seemed like he honestly didn't have answers.
Yeah, no, he was, I think he was extremely forthcoming, and there's never anything. We talked about some other like unrelated stuff, and he was like never even off the record. He was just like open book, but like, I don't think he knew what the plan was, or maybe he just didn't know Georgia has very restrictive beer laws, and I don't think that he had maybe considered them, which is why a month, almost 2 months later now, the place is still not open. They're working on their own permits, and I still don't know what it's going to be, which is so weird.
When, as someone going into that kind of conversation, I would imagine, please tell me if I'm wrong here, that like you set that up, the assumption might be that he's going to maybe not be like completely, you know, like a PR machine with these kind of by the book answers, but have pretty coherent flow to the way he's talking with you, especially when you think about maybe previous interviews or the way that he may or may not get tips, tricks from folks within, you know, the broader AB and Bev infrastructure in how to interact and talk to media. When you sit down and you start talking to someone who all of a sudden offers you kind of an interaction that you did not expect. And I felt like talking with you about this and reading it too, these kinds of responses you were getting in which it wasn't just all over the place, but kind of at times a little incoherent, I guess. But how do you react to that in the moment and then kind of shift your expectations for what you can get out of it?
Yeah, I mean, mostly it was really overwhelming because like I had never talked to him. We published stuff with him and I've read him and I knew he's well-spoken and it seemed like he's a pro at this point. You know, he's done a lot of interviews, so it's not like it's weird for him to talk to people. But in the moment, like whenever he started going, it was just so fast and so like, you know, he'd cover like seven things in two sentences and like just trying to mentally keep up with that is kind of exhausting. I've only interviewed a few people in my life where I'm just like trying to keep up and remember like, okay, that he said three things in that sentence I need to use as questions in a minute, but I have to get to this next thing because of the way the flow is going. So there was just a lot of that. And by the end, I needed to go lie down on the Beltline.
Who else were some of those people that felt overwhelming?
I'm trying to think there. I remember at my college newspaper, I interviewed Andrew WK. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's the
one sound party,
the party rocker. Yeah. And he was one of those where it was like, I would ask like, so what went into this album? And he would talk for about 10 minutes straight, just like vibing on his own words and getting worked up. And that was very much how Walt felt. It was just like, he would start going and then it's like, I can't stop. I'm going to keep talking. And it's trying to like both rein him in, but also like catch every little weird thing that you didn't expect him to say. And then be like, am I following up on that? Or am I going to keep moving in this direction? It's like trying to keep a car from hitting the wall.
What's the actual, I guess, logistical process that you go through in that moment to keep things straight on your end?
It's kind of chaos. Like hearing the three things, like if, for instance, if he says three things that I didn't expect, and then like in that moment having to decide, okay, which one is priority? Like that one sounded wild, so maybe we follow that and I can come back. Because I have some questions written down here. Those I can always get to at any point. But these little gems that he's throwing out, like when he says something like, I don't tell anyone what I'm doing, I have to stop what I'm doing and say, okay, what does that mean? You don't tell anyone what you're doing? And that really is kind of the vibe I got from him, is that he doesn't get permission and he doesn't really ask for it either in projects like these, which could be why it's not open 2 months later. I don't know.
Yeah. For someone like him, who certainly exists with some amount of fame amongst kind of industry insiders, enthusiasts, I think beer enthusiasts and professionals would certainly recognize his name given the prominence that Wicked Weed got to in a fairly short order. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, beyond, you know, the fact that his brewery made the sour beers that people really got a kick out of, and then he sold his company to Anheuser-Busch InBev, I don't know if there's a heck of a lot that people might have otherwise kind of picked up about Walt, just in the way that they may have read or heard him in the past. Are you able to, just for maybe folks who have never actually met him or seen him, can you paint something of a picture of kind of what his personality is like?
Yeah, for sure. I think we've been touching on the personality a little bit, but he has this, he kind of carries an air about him that's like he's not worried about much. He's except for like making cool things. Like I hesitate to call him a creative, but like that's the feel. Like it's like, I'm just this dude and I'm floating along and I have ideas for projects and I'm going to do them and it doesn't matter. Like that's kind of like how he feels all the time. And it's just like, what are we going to do today? Well, we're going to have this bar open in 6 hours. That's not going to happen, but that's what's in his head. And that's what he's going to work on for the next 6 hours. And it's kind of fascinating for me. Obviously he's not, resources aren't a problem. It seems like money is not a problem. And he's just kind of running with it and being like, how far can I go with this thing? And, you know, maybe along the way, not considering some of the restrictions, because like the restrictions don't exist in his head. But that's the vibe I've gotten from, you know, sitting down with him for 40 minutes one time. And also, you know, seeing him interact with people at other times.
He says the word cool 7 times in the quotes that we used in the piece.
Everything is cool.
To give a quantitative measure of how cool things are. This may be an extreme case just because of how easy flowing that conversation went. When you get that kind of set amount of time with somebody for any kind of story you're telling, what is the way that you typically try to approach that in terms of maybe working them toward that point where Walt started off with that kind of comfort level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess it, this is a cop-out, but it's like, it depends on the personality and what I know about them. And also the situation, like what we're talking about. Like sometimes you go in and you talk to someone and they've talked about a thing 100 times. And like, in that case, the goal is to try to find something new, like, and try to not retread the ground that you have things that you can already link to and quote from and all that. It's like, how do we find the next thing about this to make it interesting? But for this one, it was kind of fun because I was like, I don't know what it is. And that's the main goal. And then just getting him to talk otherwise is the rest of it. And obviously that was not a difficult thing to accomplish here. And again, with sometimes you'll know someone is kind of standoffish or weird, or maybe they're not a good interview. I didn't have any of those concerns going into this. So
that may have been opposite for the previous Sightlines piece that you wrote before that too, which was about bars that had dropped Scofflaw from their lineups.
Mm-hmm.
Just over a variety of things that people kind of either knew about publicly or was shared behind the scenes about kind of behaviors and attitudes from that brewery, which has certainly kind of, again, in insider circles, I guess, in beer has earned them a certain reputation for the way that they kind of think about business and in some ways treat other people. And for that one, I know that you had been working on that for a while, trying to, I guess, crack the willingness of people to talk to you on the record and even off the record. What was it that you found successful in terms of trying to get people to talk about some of these things that dealt with really kind of internal issues, rumors of physical altercations, to try to get people to open up about talking about these pretty serious things?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, so as a little bit of background, I worked on that story for about a year. It started in November 2017, published, I think, in December 2018. There are links in the story to Reddit and places that had like talk of the rumors online. So we'd all seen that. And then I'd have random people at events and about town saying, hey, have you heard this Scofflaw stuff? And I'm like, yeah, I've heard it, but you're just saying the things that are on the internet, which isn't very helpful. And so then I just started asking around and trying to get more specific. Eventually I got an anonymous email one day, saying my friend would like to talk to you about the Scofflaw stuff. And, none of this part ever went into the story because I talked to the person, they had information, they didn't want to do anything with it. They were thinking about it. They just wanted to it was weird. They wanted to tell me what they knew, but they didn't want it to go anywhere. And they were going to follow up with me. And I was like, okay, fine. That's great. Unfortunately, nothing ever came of that, but that was enough in that moment, that conversation, to be like, oh, I need to keep pursuing this because there's more to it. And then over time, I just kept a Google Doc of everything, everyone I talked to, everyone I could talk to, leads, like people, directions they pointed me and things like that, quotes, background. And then eventually it was sitting down with Dan Fontaine, who's the beer buyer at the Brick Store, and talking to him about a different project altogether. And he just happened to mention, oh yeah, you know, we just dropped Scofflaw the other day, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, there's our angle. Like, there's, I'm going to hang the story on this moment, and then I'm going to put everything into it I can, because I kind of just, at that point, I like needed to get it out of my system. It was like this thing that I was carrying around, and something had to be published. So that was kind of the reasoning for it ultimately.
Can you give some context about why this might be a big deal locally? And by locally, I mean you're in Atlanta, and Scofflaw, obviously being a big deal with one of the faster growing breweries in the country, very well known for some of their IPAs, and this for a few of the larger kind of beer focused bars in the area to kind of back away seems like a big deal. But is there, can you maybe give some context to the weight of what that means locally?
Sure. I mean, like I mentioned in the story, like Brick Store, so Brick Store is one of the oldest beer bars in the Southeast. They are 22 years old. So they've been around since there was barely anything to have on tap. You go back to like their early days, it was just like Bass Ale and Guinness and, you know, Sierra Nevada Pale and a couple other things. So they've really grown with the times and become this like, you know, iconic place that you go and you know there will be great beer on at all times. So they, over the years, they've dropped plenty of beer from their lineup, but usually it's something like either, you know, when Wicked Weed or Terrapin sold, they don't sell any macro beer, period. So when that happens, they drop them. When like a local brewery is having a tough time starting out and their beer doesn't taste very good, maybe it's getting sent back, they may drop that. Things like that have happened, but there's never been a moment where they decided to drop a brewery because of the things they were hearing about the people who work for the brewery. So this is a unique example in that way. And also the fact that they're not the only one. And there are only three that I got for the story before it was published, but since then several others have as well. And it's kind of this interesting moment where we published that story from Gray Chapman recently about what it means to be a small business and a brewery in particular, and dealing with the politics and beliefs and things like that. And it's really coming into like the retail space now, because like, as Dan said, it's like when you say these things about Scofflaw and we serve their beer, it's kind of like you're saying it about Brick Store. It's like, we're a supporter and we don't want to have those conversations. We don't want to be aligned with that kind of behavior. And so it's making a decision that is, I'm glad I don't have to make that decision. It's not a comfortable thing.
And there's this maybe a long time coming confluence of the reality that when people in beer, and this could be a lot of other industries, when they talk about the importance of, you know, the way that they interact and work with a distributor or a hop farmer or another brewery, they always couch it in this idea of relationships and how important relationships are in this kind of business because of the dependability and reliability that comes from it. Mm-hmm. Technically, you can do things yourself, but to grow and change in a certain way, inevitably you're going to be building partnerships and curating and being responsible toward them all over. And I think that this kind of connection between brewery and bar, especially in the last, say, couple of years, is really getting into this kind of gray area. You know, we recently on Good Beer Hunting had Michael's conversations for the Taprooms versus Everybody, and this was in the locality of Chicago and Chicagoland area, the talking about how on-premise behavior in taprooms may or may not impact relationships and what they do with and around bars and restaurants. And this example with this story in particular really kind of hits on it too, maybe the next stage or some part of the next evolution and how all of that is playing out and the way that you need to think about business and, I guess, ultimately behave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, it kind of goes both ways too, in that there's always more breweries. Like, I don't know any beer bars that are like, that are putting on everything they want to, you know, like they always have to cut something off somewhere. And so like this, in a way, it's like if a brewery is behaving in weird ways, it just makes it a little easier on you too, because it's like, well, there's one more tap line that I can put. There are 10 things that I want to put on there and we can cut this one out now. It's like a becoming a very competitive landscape. So like any of that stuff is going to play into it.
From that perspective, what's going on right now in Atlanta that is getting you exciting or something kind of new or interesting that you see going on?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. We have more breweries than ever before, which is, I think, what everybody
should. Shout out America.
But in about a year ago, we approved direct sales for the first time. So before that, you couldn't, you know, you could go to a brewery and you could buy a tour, which was like looking around at the equipment and then drinking six beers with tokens or whatever. And now it's where you can go in and you can drink unlimited beer through a tap. So you can buy pints, as many as you want at the place. And then you can take a case worth per day. We have these ridiculous limits, but it's a start in that you can go pick up a six pack or whatever you want to do and take it home. Which is great, because before that it was, you know, the margins were so low that if you were going to open a brewery in Georgia, it was like, you need to get to 5,000 barrels a year as quickly as possible, because that was kind of like the level where it was like, oh, now we're making money, now we're cruising. Whereas like a lot of the most interesting breweries in the country, you know, make 500 or 600 barrels. And a lot of them, I mean, you've told me this stat before. It's like the vast majority is less than 1,000 or something like that.
Yeah, it's like 3/4 roughly.
Yeah. So we have not, that has not existed in Georgia aside from brew pubs in the city center that, you know, mostly serve food and then serve a small amount of beer. So now, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to jump on that real quick because I maybe something of an odd question. But that, what you're talking about, that kind of brew pub downtown, tying it back maybe to the Wicked Weed story as well. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that like infrastructure and transport has helped to influence or impacted the way that beer has or does exist now in Atlanta?
In what way? What do you mean?
I don't know if there's like public transportation or just the way the city is growing and changing, if that's had some kind of impact in the way that businesses have thought about what they're doing or where they're going or the kind of people who can now get there or not get there. Sure. I was interested just in the way that like, especially Atlanta being one of the, or the Atlanta area, I guess, being one of the faster growing places in the country. Mm-hmm. I'm always curious about the way that that kind of impacts, it impacts all businesses, but especially, you know, a real estate kind of where it's a business like brewing, where it's, you know, you've got a lot of stuff. You need a certain amount of space. It can be a little dense in terms of cramming what you can into space you can, considering real estate and things like that. Are there aspects of the way that the city has changed recently that you think has impacted beer?
Yeah, well, and this ties together perfectly. So, like, there is an area of town called Summerhill that's near the old Turner Field. If you're a baseball fan, you know the Braves moved up to Cobb County, kind of north outside of the city. And they left Turner Field open, which is now going to be Georgia State. It's going to play football there. And then the nearby community, Summerhill, there's like this business district that's being developed currently. Bunch of restaurants are going to be there, barbecue place, pizza place, bakery. A lot of known names in the Atlanta area opening new places here. One of them is going to be a tiny brewery called Halfway Crooks. And going back to what we were saying, it's like, you know, 10 years ago, you open a brewery, it's like you're trying to be Sweetwater or you're trying to be something big. Like you're going to have a big industrial space, crank out as much beer as possible, put it in distribution. That's the goal. Like if you want to do this, that's the only way it can be done. Now, as the laws have changed and as development in the city changes, you can have this place like Halfway Crooks, which is shooting for something like 400 barrels next year. And they can be in a small spot in a line with a bunch of other food and drink places. And I mean, we'll see, but their business plan is set so that they can be small, selling almost all the beer out the door and kind of partnering with all their friends nearby, being like, hey, there's a restaurant there. We'll be on tap there, but mostly we're just going to sell our beer. which is exciting for me because it means like more turnover, interesting beers, not trying to like make an IPA that is 80% of your production, that kind of thing. I think for a consumer, it's a very exciting time because now we get to have those weirdos that Georgia before has not been able to have.
Tangential non sequitur. That's what's exciting you in Atlanta. We haven't really talked a heck of a lot just about good beer hunting in general. What is it that you see coming up editorially that's exciting you that we've got?
Sure. The next couple of weeks, rounding out March, is going to be really fun. We've got, I mentioned Gray Chapman earlier. She's written a critical drinking piece about the sanctity of women's only bottle shares. And it's kind of, I think it's going to be a nice follow-up. You did that piece on Eagle Rock last year where the men's rights activist was suing them because he felt like he was discriminated against. This is kind of a look at the other side, kind of a personal thing where she like goes to a women's only bottle share. She talks to some people in other cities who run them and just kind of asks the question, like, why do you think this is necessary? What about it is like comforting to you? Why do you do this? So we'll show the side that is like why these things exist. That's one. We've got a couple other big stories coming that I don't want to talk about just yet. And then we've got a funny one, a new house culture from this guy. His name is Keaton Patty. And I think most people on Twitter know him as the guy who forced a bot to watch over 1,000 hours of Olive Garden commercials. That guy, like, he's kind of turned that into a bit where he does this joke in different ways, and he posts the first page of the bot writing the script or whatever. And he's kind of turned that into like a career where he writes humor stuff for The New Yorker, The Onion, Comedy Central, McSweeney's, all these different places. And I'm really excited that he's going to be doing that for us in the term. He's doing a house culture about Whole30, which is just hilarious.
How do you find and set up that kind of thing with writers who aren't initially connected with GBH?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of them are just kind of the Twitter circles that I run in. But then sometimes it's, you know, you just see someone blowing up and it's like that person feels like they would get this. And then it's a matter of getting a hold of them, getting their email or whatever, and kind of talking through the process and getting the right idea. It's always like, sometimes I'll have an idea that I'll pitch to them, but more often I'm like, I would like for you to tell me what would be cool. Like what would make you happy right now to write?
How about Chard?
No plans for Chard in the immediate future, but who knows? I'm not going to rule it out.
I'll keep my fingers crossed. Thanks for chatting, Austin.
Yeah, man, no problem.
Talking Writing with Writers gives a special glimpse into the stories you read on Good Beer Hunting. These GBH Collective episodes are a great way for us to showcase the people behind the byline and what makes them tick. So we appreciate you spending your time with our stories, and we hope getting to know us better also adds a little more nuance to the words you read and voices you hear. Keep an eye out for more GBH Collective podcasts as we talk to fellow Good Beer Hunting writers and other media members who cover and think about beer. We'll dive into what it takes to create engaging stories and the behind-the-scenes work to bring it all together. As always, our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.